deep inside a cave. You are surrounded by complete darkness. The air is cold and still. Your senses are overwhelmed. Which way is up? You fumble for your torch. Its light reveals a secret etched on the walls. 4,000 years of sacred markings. 500 years of exchange, conversations, and bloodshed. The meeting of two worlds. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. In this series, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Our guest on today's episode of What's Your Map has travelled to some of the furthest reaches of the world to bring us startlingly vivid insights into the past. Dr. Jago Cooper is an archaeologist who has spent over 20 years researching the indigenous cultures of South America and the Caribbean. His work is about the dramatic effect that climate change, European colonization, and technological transformations have had on the region. His career has taken him from the heights of Machu Picchu in Peru to uninhabited islands off the coast of northern Cuba. You may recognize him from his numerous BBC 4 films on the wonders of South and Central American archaeology. When he's not traveling around the Americas, Jago is the Professor of Art and Archaeology at the University of East Anglia and Director of the Sainsbury Centre for Visual Arts, following 10 years as Head of the Americas at the British Museum. Jago, welcome to What's Your Map? I'm really looking forward to digging into the map you brought with you today, which is very, very different from many of the maps we usually see. Tell me about this.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation. I have to say this is one of the most simple maps you must have had on your project, and that is because I sort of helped make it. And the thing I love about it is that what appears to be so simple is actually revealing one of the greatest discoveries that I've ever seen.
That's quite a statement, because really what we're looking at is a small diagram with some dots and some stars and the entrance clearly to a cave. But just tell me what it is that we're looking at. What are we seeing here on this graphic?
So this is just a few cave chambers of a big cave system that stretches for a few kilometres. And what we're looking at is how the interweaving chambers of the cave are sort of underground, different dimensions, and then the dots are representative of the amazing discoveries that we found on the walls of this cave.
So this is very unusual, and I think this is fascinating, because usually we think about a map as a graphic that is sort of drawn, but this is actually, it's in a cave, and it's what we call a petroglyph. It's carved into the stone, isn't it? Tell me where it is and your relationship to this, because this is quite extraordinary.
So this cave is one of more than 150 different cave systems on an uninhabited island in the Caribbean called Isla de Mona. And it truly is an extraordinary uninhabited island. These cave systems are enormous. The island has the largest coastal cave system in the world, with 22 kilometres of map tunnels. And for more than a decade, we've been exploring these cave systems. And inside them, because you don't get many humans visiting the island, there are time capsules of all the people that have been onto the island over the last 8,000 years. Inside the cave systems, as you travel into the deep, dark zones of the caves, in certain areas, what happens is that the walls turn into a sort of putty. There's like a black exterior on the wall. And then if you run your fingers through the soft putty-like texture of the wall, a gleaming white is revealed. And so that's what people do. They go into these caves and they draw with their fingers onto the walls. So over the last decade, we've now found probably the largest collection of indigenous art in the whole of the Caribbean created on the walls of the caves.
And this is what the map is showing us, so marking the different sites. the distinction? Is it between markings which seem to be indigenous and then those that seem to be colonial Spanish, sort of post-Columbus moment?
Exactly. So in this cave, the darker dots represent indigenous art, and the circles, the clear circles, are what make the cave extraordinary, because Christopher Columbus stops on this island on his second voyage, and the indigenous community then is actually inhabited, and there are villages on the island, and this indigenous community becomes one of the first trading partners for the very, very first European towns being built in the Americas. And what this cave represents is indigenous people taking some of the very first Europeans to arrive in the Americas into this cave system, deep, deep underground, deep into a dark zone, a place you would never find unless you knew how to find it. And on the walls of the cave, they are showing the Europeans their belief systems, their understandings of the world, and how they are trying to sort of communicate themselves and their identity. And then the Europeans are responding visually onto the cave walls with biblical quotes, representations of Christianity, Christograms, and their names, so we can identify who they were.
This is amazing, because you don't usually think that a cave would be that point of contact. You think of a beach or you think of a village. Why is this, as it were, underground? Why is this the space of encounter, as it were?
And I think this is a really interesting question about space and how we perceive space. So the indigenous belief systems center around an idea of an origin myth about Casibahagua, which is that humans emerged from a cave. And therefore, the caves become these exceptionally important spiritual locations amongst indigenous communities in the Caribbean. And these markings on the walls are representative of their belief systems. And so the knowledge of who in that indigenous community had the right to go into that cave, they're very, very difficult locations to find underground. Sometimes you're like hundreds and hundreds of meters underground in very, you know, hard to reach places. And yet that particular cave chamber would be of particular spiritual importance. And then these markings on the wall would represent their belief systems. So for the Europeans, caves were like obscure, dark, scary, or smuggling, or pirates, or have a sort of connotation of that. Whereas for indigenous populations, it was like going into their cathedral. It was going into their sort of St. Paul's Cathedral and sort of revealing the essence of their way of life.
Just give me a sense of what the indigenous imagery is in the cave. And also, to what extent do you think it is a map? Because could you call this art, or could you call this ethnography, or could you call this a map? What is it that you're seeing there, Jacob? Tell me.
Large numbers of the artistic representations are representations of humans and animals, and nearly always in the process of change. So often you'll get humans in lizard form or birds turning out into bats, and you get this idea that the cave is a liminal space of transition into a sort of spiritual realm, and in it, like magic in the broadest sense, is happening inside that cave. So the imagery is linked to ancestors. It's linked to understanding how the community can learn or answer questions about their own identity and their connection with the landscape through this idea of transition. And the cave is like a space which is different to being, like, I don't know if you've ever been inside caves, but when you go into the dark zone, the senses go, there's no, obviously no vision, but there's also the smells change, and your human brain completely transforms in how you perceive things. And that sensation of it, of space and also time, is transformed. And the imagery sort of accentuates that, changes it, and it's just crazy stuff on the wall to look at.
I've been to spaces in the Northern Cape in South Africa and seen these kind of markings. And it is fascinating, isn't it? You go into this space and, as you say, suddenly you're in a different realm. But these are different. Again, I think these are quite extraordinary in terms of markings, because as a map, I suppose, how would we define a map? I tend to say a map is a graphic representation of a spatial environment. That'll do. For me, that does. So that covers so much. So for me, this is it's a world, isn't it? It's showing you a world, but it's also a world in transition, because it's a world that then is encountering a European culture as well. Tell me some of your favourite images here. What's particularly fascinating for you?
So in this case, some of my favourite images is that there is an ancestral figure. So an indigenous mark of a sort of ancestral figure, which is like a human figure, beautifully carved in this absolutely gorgeous alcove with glistening calcites and beautiful light reflecting off the water in the cave. And then on either side of it are two very early 16th century European crosses that is creating the story of the Calvary, of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And so you have one on one side wall, you have a normal Calvary with the word Jesus written underneath it. And on the other, by placing two crosses on either side of the ancestral figure, they're creating a sort of indigenous Calvary. Like, this is your Jesus, this is our Jesus, and they're creating this visual dialogue. And there's a very good chance they may not have even been speaking the same language at this point, or having that sort of form of communication. So that idea of communication through image is a really key point.
And so when are the European images, are they 16th century?
So they span between sort of very late 15th century, potentially, and then up to a sort of 1590. And so we're seeing on the island a real position of transformation and also transition and the nature of those relationships. And that is why this is exceptionally interesting. And then also we get the names of certain of the Europeans. So Francisco Alegre writes his name on the wall. And then in the Archivo de los Indios in Seville, we found the same signature by the same guy in the archive, and then matched the signature to identify who it was. And you can identify when he left Spain, what his role was in Puerto Rico. And so it's a really interesting and intimate dialogue of space. And the other thing I think about maps, you talked about the concept of a map. I totally agree that idea of 2D representations of the space. But we have to understand that there is no maps in the Americas before Europeans arrive. It's an entirely Western concept. And the entire concept of space and the human body and how you move through things is just completely different. And that's why I love the way this encounter is happening in a cave, because they're these sort of weird three-dimensional spaces. It's always 2D and it looks flat, but actually this cave, some's up, some's down, there's like tunnels, you're all over the place, and actually you can't even tell which way's up sometimes when you're in there. And the art is in different places, it's in nooks, it's in crannies. And so like the Europeans are coming in there with their own understanding of space, of domination, of control. The map is often a form of ownership that they're then controlling space, understanding how it works, sort of drawing the little walls, creating their city boundaries. Whereas I feel like when they're coming in here, they're just completely discombobulated, totally sort of like out of their comfort zone.
And kind of telling us a different story, that we tend to think this is a moment of European domination and Europeans bring maps in and then there's the destruction of the indigenous communities. But this is a very, very different kind of encounter, isn't it? As you say, there's no orientation, there's no north, south, up, down. And a map is usually, what does a map usually do? It takes three dimensions and turns it into two. But you walk into this cave and you see something very different. Tell me, how did you first come across it, and what's the backstory to this cave and your involvement as an archaeologist in it?
So this is a collaboration I do with my brilliant co-director, Alice Sampson, and we've been doing it for more than 12 years. And do you want the honest story of how it came about?
Of course I do.
So maybe 20 years ago, I was working in Cuba on a big project and Alice was working in the Dominican Republic, and we were at a conference and we drank all night, and on the back of a bar mat, we wrote what would be our dream future project if we ever get good enough to get a good job. And on the back of the bar mat was an uninhabited island in the Caribbean. Not many people have worked there before, and incredible archaeology. And so when I got my job at the British Museum in 2011, I then said, phoned her and was like, we're on. And then we spent a summer exploring different and uninhabited islands in the Caribbean, looking for places with archaeology. So when we first turned up on Mona, some people had worked, the Rouse had worked there in the 1940s, but we were going to look at some bull courts, some indigenous sort of landscape bull courts, which is like these ceremonial plazas, and we didn't really know anything about the caves. And so when we got to the island, the first time we went into the first cave with our iPhones, went in underground, started to see stuff on the walls, and then after like an hour, the iPhone battery started to go. We turned around to leave, and it was just like total amateur hour. We just realized that we like needed to do this properly. So then we have had some big collaborations with some cave explorers and had really quite big teams over the years with Pat Cambyses and Mike Lay, some of the foremost cave explorers in the world. And then we went back properly and then worked with them who are exploring the cave systems to then systematically go through all of the cave systems and identify and record every visual signifier of the subterranean cultural landscape over more than a decade.
What was your first experience of walking into that cave? I mean, it must have been quite extraordinary.
It is absolutely extraordinary. The first time I saw it, a lot of it, we weren't even sure what it was, because this is very different types of archaeology than you find in other places. The nature of these cave walls means that people draw extensively, huge images. And a lot of, we've worked in the Caribbean for many, many years, but a lot of the imagery we'd never seen before. And we were like, wait a second, is this even indigenous? Is it like contemporary graffiti? Is like, what's going on? And so it took us a while to sort of identify and then do a serious amount of science. So we did uranium-thorium dating of the stalactite drips coming over the top of them, did radiocarbon dates of some of the pictographs, found pre-Columbian torches that we could radiocarbon date in situ in some of the caves. And so it took a while to sort of build up this picture and level of confidence that we really knew and understood what we looked at.
I'm just curious, again, going back to the map, about the distinctions between indigenous and European.
Yeah.
What are the stars on the map?
So this is where we're then taking charcoal samples from the floor. So indigenous populations take firebrand torches, some of which we found, into the cave systems. Bits of charcoal drop out and land on the floor. And sometimes when they're untrammeled spaces, like people haven't been in there for, you know, it's hundreds of years, then you can pick up the tiny bits of charcoal off the floor, and then you can radiocarbon date them and date when, well, when the tree died, but when that person was going into that cave system. And it's a scientific way of proving the dates of some of the markings on the walls.
And what does that tell us about the indigenous population and what happens to them? Because also I'm curious what the history is. It's the Taino, is it?
Yes.
The Taino have been there, obviously, before European contact. But how long, Jago? And then what happens to them post the European contact?
So one of the things which is interesting about the island is when it's inhabited and when it's not. So broadly speaking, people are living in the Caribbean for at least 8,000 years. And then on this particular island, you're looking at sort of, we've got evidence of 4,000 years ago, there are definitely people on the island. And then there's this huge flurry of activity that really takes off in a big way around 1200 AD. And then we've got a lot of work and a lot of indigenous art appearing between 1200 AD up until the end of the 15th century with the arrival of Columbus. And that is the sort of time when we're getting a huge flurry of activity.
Why post 1200?
In the wider Caribbean, there is this huge population expansion. We get same thing with huge number of sites start getting built in the Dominican Republic and in Cuba and Puerto Rico. You get these big bull court sites starting getting created. You get these big ceramic traditions start coming in with these very elaborate, beautiful carving, beautiful carved wood. And there are different theories about why you get this big population expansion. Some is linked to climatic reasons. Some is just linked to big social organization, increases in agriculture. But no one really actually has a really brilliant answer, to be honest.
And then, of course, Columbus arrives 1492. So then what happens to the Taino at that point? Because it's pretty, they're pretty much, they're not lost, but they're hugely affected by the encounter.
So what's really interesting about this island is that we see that transition materially. So outside of this cave, we are also excavating the indigenous villages where the indigenous population is living. So we see the very first arrival of European material culture. Mm. And by studying the nature of those interrelationships of the material culture, actually, yes, like there's arguments to say that actually when Europeans arrive, you know, they haven't got a clue what they're doing, right? And then within very short space of time, they're indeed eating indigenous foods. They're wearing cotton clothing that they're sort of like trading for off the indigenous population. They're sleeping in hammocks, an entirely indigenous technology. And culturally, they're already changing and they're adopting totally indigenous ways of living. The fact they're writing these letters back saying, you know, we're in charge, we're Europeans, actually, the information looks like it's not like that at all. And then what happens is, as increasingly size of these towns start getting built and things start to dominate, then control becomes stronger under the European systems, and people start getting moved, and the indigenous population, the conditions start to appear to get worse on this island. They start to get a thing called an encomienda, where the land is given to someone to then own, and then by sort of 1590, the last of the population is taken off island because they're seen as being uncontrollable. Because there's no European town ever built on this island. It's like it's an island out of this sort of European control. And therefore, they're taken away.
Because the population reduces by 80 to 90%?
Yes.
Because of enslavement, disease. Yes. I mean, that's quite extraordinary. And yet, what you do want to tell is a slightly different story to the one that just says this is simple colonial exploitation, that there's an encounter, there's an exchange, there are people learning from each other to some extent, and that within the cave and what you see in those markings is that encounter, which goes a bit two-way.
Yes, I am. It sounds odd and provocative, but I am someone who believes that Europeans become extinct in the Caribbean, you know, just as much as indigenous culture becomes, like, is affected too. Like, actually, what is culture? How do we actually live? How do things actually work? Like, actually, things change. Like, our culture is our values, it's how we live, it's our day-to-day, and that's a lot more. And because European systems of communication, like maps and writing, start to dominate, that gives a false impression of the nature of actual cultural control, I think. Mm. And I think that's interesting. And that's why maps are particularly interesting, because that gives a sort of Western concept of space and ownership and proprietorial sort of knowledge.
Before we return to Jago to hear about his journey into archaeology and museums, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping sounds to charting constellations, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series, or the next. Now, back to Jago to hear about the anima and lives of cultural objects. So I'm curious to also step back and ask you a bit about, you know, what drove you into archaeology? When did you decide that you wanted to be an archaeologist? And you obviously wanted to slightly take different routes into that discipline than what many people would imagine an archaeologist does.
Yeah, so I see absolutely no distinction between art or anthropological object or archaeology. I see no distinction, right? I've never have done. I just see any materialization of culture being the same thing, right? My mum was an artist and was like, you know, contemporary artist. And then my local museum where I grew up happened to be an archaeology museum because it was in Cirencester and it was like a local Roman museum. So then I joined the local museum club when I was six and then just got into archaeology. But I literally don't see a distinction between a Roman statue and a contemporary, you know, Rothko. I don't see a distinction. I never have done. And then I've studied art history and I've studied anthropology and I've studied archaeology. And now I'm in a position where I can sort of meld the lot and not have to worry about it anymore. But I think it's a false construct. I think humans materialize the ways that they live and that when they do that, they are creating something that communicates. And that is the same for all humans. And we're the only species that creates art. And that's what we do.
And in a way, that's what you've been seeing in the cave. And I'm similarly drawn to maps because I think a map is presumably always a fusion of science and art. It's always a fusion of visual and written. It always is. It is that interesting question, I guess, of the art and science connection. And then, yeah. I guess, did that in any way influence people make decisions about where they work? And it's a sort of paraphrase of the Mrs. Merton connections in what drew you to work in the beautiful Caribbean.
Yeah, I think I really like human culture and how it's different. I like that. I like the difference. I like exploring the difference in humanity. And I also like, I have had a few moments in my life when I've realized that other people think in such a fundamentally different way than I thought I think. And like lots of assumptions that I've made in my life, you realize they get completely overturned. And like spatial representation is one of them, like how I see landscape, how I see space. Like I've had that completely overturned in my life by working with communities, both past and present, that see the landscape differently. And I think that's really interesting. And like, why, you know, how can it be that like you have millions and millions of people in the Americas who never drew a map? They never saw space in the same way. And I think that's fascinating.
Well, and also in that longer archaeological history about South and Central America, it's very cut off in some ways from, you know, what we call the old world. And so there's a very specific reason, I guess, to work in that area that's different. If you're working in sub-Saharan Africa or you're working in Southeast Asia, there's a certain history that we're familiar with. You know, I'm interested in writing about exploration and those early, you know, thousands of years ago. The Americas are different, aren't they? There's a different culture, there's a different history. You know, the Bible has no conception of the Americas. Yep. So there's something very specific that drives people's archaeological interest in there that's different from, say, if you were going to work on Africa.
There is, 100%, and that's why it's great. And one of those links is the relationship between culture and nature and environment and landscape. So if you look at a landscape from a Western perspective, the human is often looking at it as a sort of objective space and you sort of draw lines on it and create your map of it. Whereas if you understand yourself as being part of that landscape, actually linked to it, and physically connected to it, then you see that landscape in a completely different way and how you talk about it and how you describe it and what it actually looks like. So often a landscape in that context is a series of sort of interventions by humans and nature over time. It's like a sort of what's been called by some academics as a taskscape in which not a landscape, but a taskscape. It's a composition of different elements of natural and cultural products over time. And so what you're looking at is actually lots and lots of time bound up in one thing that you're looking at. So if you drew, it would never make sense to draw a line around it and call it one thing, because it's not. It's multiple things. It's a moving, dynamic space. And to draw a line just wouldn't make sense cognitively, because it's not that. It's like trying to draw a spider diagram of relationships rather than an actual physical space as a line. And so once you start to play with that in your mind, that what you're looking at in terms of space is a set of relationships, not like a thing you draw with a line, then you, like, it starts to blow your mind. And then you're like, well, then how does anything work? Mm. You know, there's no ownership in the Americas. Like, people don't own stuff. You don't own land. You know, you don't draw a line, there's no frontiers, there's no borders, there's no, you know, that's just not how people conceive landscape. And then once you go down that rabbit hole, then you're just like, you can't leave, it's just too interesting.
And that's what's interesting about a map. We usually tell history through time, but actually telling history through space is a different way of doing it. And then you need maps. So, I mean, it is fascinating in that respect. And because I'm also struck by, you know, as there's the problem with the loss of an indigenous community in terms of what happens to the Taino in this area, how do you then do the archaeological work in relationship to surviving indigenous groups? Is there any way in which that's a meaningful dialogue that you can have? And what does that look like?
Yeah, it's important to say that there are Taino still exist, right? The Taino still exist. And particularly in the early 2000s, when DNA started to be created and people started taking DNA tests, there was this absolute explosion when there were these headlines in the newspapers saying, you know, 70% of Puerto Ricans have indigenous DNA. And that idea of sort of colonization and extinction suddenly got completely overturned. And then it started to play into the politics of Puerto Rico, and concepts of indigeneity, indigenous identity, and understanding of independence in the Caribbean as being separate from countries of colonization, then that all came into play. So what's interesting is in more recent times, indigenous concepts and indigenous ownership of being indigenous has transformed in the Caribbean. And this, again, plays into that narrative.
And this is why this is fascinating, Jago, because, you know, you are director of the Sainsbury Centre, and it's quite clear if people listen to both your passion, but also how you talk about history and objects and space, that you've relaunched the museum and you've got this concept of recognising art as living objects. I think this is fabulous because I think it's really changing how we think about museums and how visitors interact with the objects. What does it mean, though? Tell me about this vision that you have. I think it's fabulous, but just explain it.
I've always worked in museums. But they have, for me, they had a problem which needed to be changed, which is that the model of the museum is that whatever is in it, like art, material, culture, pottery, it's understood as property. And the museum is a sort of beneficial ownership structure that looks after this property and gives access to the public to it. And that's great. Love museums, love all museums. But it denies the emotional power of what it can do. It starts off the conversation that you own it. So how do you justify owning other people's stuff? Difficult place to start. And also it means that anyone entering one of those spaces feels like there's some authority that's going to introduce them to this collection they're getting privileged access to, which rules out half the country, right? Most people don't go to museums because they don't like going into these spaces of sort of authority. So I wanted to create a museum with a fundamentally different construct and starting point. So if you're not going to understand material culture and art as property, what is it? For me, there is something unique about humans. Like, we all know that inside us is this weird thing, right? It's like, as a child, when we're growing up, we realize that there's a sort of spark of life force contained within this body of flesh and soul. And if we are religious, we might use words like spirit and soul. And if we're more rationalist, we use words like consciousness or an ability of self-reflective thought. But for me, great artists, makers, and creators are people who have an ability to channel this raw aspect of human life force. In the case of visual arts, they're materializing it through their hands into clay, through the brush onto a canvas. And at that moment, an aspect of this raw human anima transfers into this material object, and it becomes a living entity. It's actually alive, imbued with the life force of humanity. It's not a human because it hasn't got a human body, but it is alive, right? So in 2023, we became the first museum in the world to understand our collection as living entities. We changed the governance and roles of everyone at the museum, so their job is no longer to preserve, protect, and communicate the collection, which is the primary job of everyone else. The mission is to give these living entities their best lives. It sounds kooky as hell, but honestly, it genuinely works. Because once you come into the museum, the front desk, you're told, you're here to meet these, we understand the collection being alive, please meet these much more like you would another human than you would an inanimate object. And we've got a whole series of ways for you to formulate those relationships. And there is no distinction between a Picasso painting and a Jumon ceramic from Japan from 5,000 years ago, because they're all alive, right? One's just more experienced than the other, but they're all present in the moment, and they're living entities. So there is no distinction. There's an equal platform for all forms of art and culture in a cultural dialogue across time and space.
And what kind of examples can you give of how that operates? I saw one was a great one because, you know, being from Yorkshire, I love Henry Moore, and you have women hugging a Henry Moore, mother and child, and I found it very powerful. I mean, is that an example of how you think about that object as having this anima that you describe?
Yeah, so that's one of the many experiences you can do. So it goes, you're asked to go up to the sculpture of Henry Moore's Mother and Child, look into the mother's eyes, and then close your eyes and try and remember the earliest memory you can of being held as a child. The earliest memory you can of being held as a child. And with your eyes closed, reach out, run your hand down the back of the Henry Moore sculpture, feel the tactility of the stone, the curvature of the back, and that feeling of security and protection you can have when you're held in someone else's arms. Then open your eyes and look at it and realize that art isn't a set of symbols to be translated. It's an emotional state of mind to be in. And if you can find that right place within yourself, then you can connect with the life force of any work of art. And that relationship, just like it can be with a human, is what formulates our own identity. How we choose our values, what we think is right and wrong, how we explore the biggest emotions we have, is by having relationships with other human beings. And because art is live and a living entity, it absolutely gives back to you and allows you to explore those ideas and concepts in a way which is different, but often better than humans, right? You can tell, another thing you can do is tell a Giacometti painting a secret that you would never tell another human being, right? You can trust the painting to hold the secret. And that space between you can be a place of inspiration, imagination, just a safe space to think about big questions. And so when you see people in the gallery doing these things, they are genuinely connecting, right? They're connecting with it and exploring those thoughts. And great art is great art because if you invest in it, it gives back to you. That is what defines great art in my mind.
But you know that as an archaeologist, because most non-Western indigenous societies have that belief in anima. I mean, our post-modern Western world doesn't really have that same sense. You know, you describe a Henry Moore or a Picasso, and you don't give it that sense of its thingness. Yeah. But it is from archaeology and also a bit of anthropology.
Yeah, I think many contemporary artists feel it. Well, like when I say, look, I think it's alive, it's living in, they're like, of course it is, you know. Lots of them say they are the conduits for this thing that they can't explain, and lots of them feel that that idea of the concept of anima is true. And so, I think it is something that is a universal human trait. Like, why the hell is it that all these cultures create art? Like, why have we always done it? And why is every human, like, why? Like, and like, it's to explain the unexplained. It's to like explore questions. It's to understand things that we don't understand. Yeah. And that materialization, by being with it, then you're exploring that completely different cultural perspective on whatever it is you're thinking about. And that is interesting, because then you can connect in a museum with like the most incredible individuals, political movements, cultural perspectives from across time and space in a completely different way. And that's like fun.
Yeah. You want to take your audience to the cave, don't you? Yeah, that would be the ultimate living art experience, right? But do tell me a bit about that, because I'm fascinated. That is an encapsulation, isn't it? The cave is a piece of your manifesto of living art. That's really what it is. It's just we can't all go there.
I love that idea of the experiential immersion within a space that discombobulates you, and then you see something that formulates that relationship. And it absolutely does. Like, if you take, like, a museum can often feel sterile or conformist or authoritarian, or, but like that idea of taking people into unusual circumstances, I enjoy it. And we try to do that in a meaningful way. And I think that's why art in landscape and moving through different places and taking the human body into other parts of the world, like, I find that really interesting. That's how people change their perceptions, change how they think, and expose themselves to change that inner value system that we all have.
Please keep doing what you're doing. I'm sorry I can't come to the cave with you. It's been an absolute pleasure, Jago Cooper, to listen to you. Thank you for joining me so much on What's Your Map? An absolute pleasure.
Great. Thanks so much.
I can't wait to visit the Sainsbury Centre and experience Jago's living art theory in action. It's clear that his work in the cave system of Isla de Mona had a huge personal impact and helped to shape his understanding of different civilizations and belief systems. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.